Today is Monday, November 30th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History Interview, Part 10, with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing well.
Great. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. At the end of part nine, you were recounting how back in 1988 at Petrified Forest National Park, you were the resource manager, but you had been offered an acting job as chief ranger. Can you pick that thread up?
Yeah, so what had happened was my boss, Chris Andrus, gotten a promotion. He was going to be, if I remember right, he was going to be the chief ranger of the Mid-Atlantic region.
Wow.
So obviously a promotion for him. And so he chose me to be acting until that chief ranger position was filled. And at the time, we had direct reports were me as resource management specialist, and then we had two district rangers, one for the Painted Desert District at the north end of the park and one at the Rainbow Forest District for the south end of the park, and then we had a division clerk.
Okay.
And since we had the division was both interpretation and resource management and law enforcement, so it was kind of a everything division, and so the chief ranger or the district ranger at the south end of the park, Greg Caffey, had a law enforcement background. The district ranger at the north end of the park, Terry Mays, had an interpretation background, and then I was the resource management person. And when Chris told me or offered me or whatever the acting role, Greg Caffey, I was most concerned about the law enforcement part of it. I'd worked in interpretation, and so that part I knew at least with some degree of familiarity.
Right.
But I'd never really done law enforcement, and so that was the part that really concerned me.
Because mm-hmm.
there's a lot of things that can go wrong in law enforcement.
Yeah.
And his logic was that, well, two directions. One was that Greg, the Rainbow Forest District Ranger, had just started in the park.
So okay.
He was a new district ranger, and he thought it would be unfair to kick him all the way up to acting chief ranger when he just gotten his first district ranger position.
Hmm.
And also Chris saw the resource management / research, science research, archaeological research, all that kind of stuff going on at the park as the more difficult of the facets to grasp. And so he thought I would be the one to handle that. And so that's why I got the chief ranger position. And we did spend quite a bit of time going over stuff. You know, I was familiar with the research end of things. I kind of had a fair idea of what was going on in the other divisions or in the other specialties, but at the same time there was a lot of things I didn't know, so we did go over a lot of stuff. The problem is, of course, that you never really know what you're going to need to know ahead of time.
Yeah.
And what I quickly discovered and I mentioned before was that Chris had a phenomenal ability to just keep things in his head and juggle them all around. And so in spite of both of our best efforts, once he was off to Philadelphia, I had a lot of work to do that I really, really took me by surprise.
Like what?
Well, looking back on it, I should have foreseen it, but you know, I had to get like the entire division budget onto paper.
Oh wow!
So I could track it and stuff. He could just juggle that all in his head. He knew what he had, knew where it was going, and all that kind of stuff. And this was back in the days of paper. We were using spreadsheets on the computer, but all of the official stuff was done on paper, and then sent back and forth to the regional office or whatever. So it took me a while to get all that stuff together there.
And that would be budget for vehicles and training and housing. I don't know, salaries. Trying to think of what else would be on that. And you'd have to figure that out for each person, or.
Yes. It was the personnel costs weren't the most difficult. You know, that was pretty much formulaic. You knew who was working and how much they made and that kind of stuff. So,
okay.
So that you could just plug right in. But it was the unanticipated costs.
Huh.
Different things that would come up. You know, I remember during my tenure we had to buy a new fire truck.
Oh.
And stuff like that. So
that's a big ticket.
Things like that.
Where do you get the money for that? I mean, that's a big ticket item that would come up. Where would you have the funding where you could pull that around and make that work?
As I recall, and this is one I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that the money would have come from the regional office.
Okay.
Kind of where you put it and you say, hey, you know, our old fire truck is from 1920 or whatever, and they plug it in and they say, oh, well, you know, the fire truck at Great Sand Dunes is from 1917, so we're going to buy theirs first, and then we'll buy you one.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right.
You know, so that there would be outside sources for that sort of stuff. But it was still, you know, still had to make it all come together.
Hmm. Okay.
So,
and what else caught you that kind of unprepared?
Well, I think just the workload. You know, there was just a lot of stuff to keep track of. So, needless to say, I wasn't spending much time out in the field or that sort of stuff. Most of my resource management type duties I had palmed off on other people. So I had a couple of folks who were doing almost all the air quality work. I had some range technicians who were handling the tamarisk removal program in the summertime and that sort of thing. So I didn't. You know, I was pretty much out of the picture in terms of resource management type things.
Okay.
But the one thing I did do is periodically the Park Service was hosting conferences on paleontology in national parks.
Hmm.
It was one of those where there were actually quite a few Park Service areas where paleontology was the primary focus of the parks, and then a lot of other parks that had significant fossil resources, even though it wasn't a primary focus. So in the first group, you'd have places like Petrified Forest, like Dinosaur National Monument,
right,
like Nevada, Utah, John Day Fossil Beds, Hagerman Fossil Beds, you know, a lot of these different fossil parks. And then in the second category, you would have places like Grand Canyon, or Yellowstone, Badlands National Park, that had these significant fossil resources, but they might not be the primary focus of park management.
Right.
And so the idea behind these conferences was hey, you guys, you know, let's start getting our act together, make sure that everybody's doing things the same, doing things according to policy and law and that sort of thing. And there had been a fossil conference, been, I believe, about 1985 or 1986, that was held at the Dinosaur National Monument. And I got sort of an invitation to attend that one. I was still at Grand Canyon at the time. And Grand Canyon wasn't interested in sending me, but they said, you know, if you want to take annual leave and go up there, you can go.
Huh.
And so I did.
Huh.
Yeah, so I took a few days of annual leave and drove up to Vernal, Utah, and attended the conference. And it was very good. It was
cool.
You know, kind of a orientation to it. Then the second conference was going to be hosted by Petrified Forest. And as chief ranger, I know this seems kind of odd, but I just really don't remember that conference, even though when I look back through, you know, some of my records and that kind of stuff, I find out that, yeah, I was coordinating a whole bunch of it.
You know, oh, wow.
Giving presentations and that kind of stuff. And for whatever reason, I think it's just because there was so much going on at the time.
Hmm.
I just really don't remember that conference.
Okay.
But I do remember that some of the issues that we were trying to get our heads around, trying to bring some semblance of order, was just collecting permits.
Ah.
That, I mean, you know, any researcher that's collecting in a national park has to have a research permit.
Mm-hmm.
And then has to have a method of keeping whatever they collect available for future study if they don't destroy it in the course of their study.
Okay.
And so that part was all relatively straightforward, and most people had a relatively good handle on that, even though I know a lot of parks weren't, shall we say, as good as they should have been about keeping things in public repositories.
Hmm.
But one thing that a lot of folks didn't know was that vertebrate remains require a special permit that comes through the Smithsonian.
Really?
And I'm not sure why that is, but that's just the way the rules were worked out.
Hmm.
And so, you know, just getting folks up to speed on all that kind of stuff was an important part of it. And then another big part of it was just, you know, what are different parks doing to keep track of their fossil resources.
Okay.
So that was something that we hosted and that I was apparently intimately involved in, but just basically
I see.
Basically don't remember too much about.
Where would that event have been held? I mean, did you guys have an auditorium, or where did you?
We did, and it's hard for me to say. I know that, you know, Petrified Forest has no lodging, so I'm sure that everybody was staying in Holbrook.
Right.
But we did Petrified Forest National Park, the Painted Desert end of the park, had one of the last one-room schoolhouses
in oh, wow.
Arizona. And by that time, it was the one-room schoolhouse actually had a couple of rooms, but it was part of the Mission 66 Painted Desert Visitor Center complex, where one building in the complex was the school. It had a classroom that was dividable so that you could make it into two rooms if you wanted to. Restrooms, there was a little break room, and then there was a small gym, which also served the community as well.
Okay.
And I remember, you know, it was big enough for a volleyball court, and we would play volleyball in there after work and that kind of stuff. And that room was also one that we could use for conferences and that sort of thing. So I'm pretty sure that gymnasium / multipurpose room was probably where we held the conference.
Okay.
And like I say, by that time the school was the one room school was no more, and I think that was in the mid 80s that they finally started schlepping the kids off to Holbrook, and that room became the law enforcement offices for the north end of the park.
So put that program together. What about the general management plan? You've mentioned that.
Well, we're working on a general management plan for Petrified Forest National Park, mostly because of all the new research that was going on there.
Okay.
And, of course, the purpose of a general management plan is, it's just that. It's an outline of the general management goals, how the park should manage its resources and what its longer-term goals are, say, over the next 10 to 20 years. And it looks at things like resource protection, visitor experience, and all that sort of thing. And like I say, the need for a resource or a general management plan at Petrified Forest was driven in large part by all the research that was going on. And it was a process that started, at least in its formative stages, started while Chris was still there and wasn't quite finished when I left in 1991.
Hmm.
But I was there for most of it. And I think one of the, aside from the growing swell of paleontological and archaeological research that was going on in the park, we had started to get some biological research going on, you know, the tamarisk control that we were doing. There was some interest in studying the pronghorn population in the park, the prairie dog research. So it wasn't all archaeology and paleontology. We had other kinds of research going on at the time. And then I don't remember exactly when it happened, but at one point, the Bureau of Land Management was looking at transferring some of their land to other land management agencies.
Hmm.
In northeastern Arizona, BLM doesn't have very large holdings. You know, you've got the big Navajo Nation up to the north. You've got the National Forests to the south, and then beyond that, the Apache reservations. And so there's just kind of a strip between those two, with Interstate 40 in the north and the forests in the south. And a lot of that land was checkerboarded state and private land, with the Bureau of Land Management just having odds and ends scraps here and there.
Oh, wow.
And so consequently, what they were trying to do was to kind of consolidate land ownership, either theirs or other federal agencies, just so we had better management.
Okay.
And so one of the criteria that they'd come up with was that if there was a BLM land adjacent to another land management agent, you know, Forest Service or Park Service or Fish and Wildlife Service, that was a designated wilderness area, that BLM was going to just transfer that land to the other agency.
Oh, wow.
And since national parks are established by congressional action, I'm not sure exactly how what the legalese behind all that was. But we did have some BLM sections adjacent to Petrified Forest National Park.
Hmm.
And so I'd gone out and taken a look at them. And one of the things that I discovered, it was just a few square miles of BLM land. But I got to thinking, you know, we should, besides just looking and seeing, you know, if we're going to take this land just because the Bureau of Land Management happens to own it, we should also probably take a look at the park boundaries and see if they're really where they should be in relationship to everything that we know that's going on in the park today. And so I started just kind of looking with a broader brush. And I had come up with some boundaries that were more physiographic. Instead of just straight lines across the landscape, they followed outcrops of rocks or drainage basins or whatever that, to me anyway, seemed to make a little bit more sense. Then, while I was, I believe it was chief ranger, a couple of things happened. One of them was the Navajo Hopi land settlement, where the, to make a long story short, the Hopi had a reservation, the Navajo Nation, they had a reservation, but they overlapped around the Hopi mesas. And there was this vast area that they were both supposed to be sharing, but it wasn't working out all that well. And so there was a long, long process of dividing up what was called the joint use area into discrete Hopi and Navajo sections. And part of that was also acquiring more land for the Navajos that would be displaced off the Hopi sections. And and so one of the ranches adjacent to the park was purchased to accommodate Navajos, expansion of the Navajo Nation. And another ranch adjacent to the park was up for sale. And both of these ranches did have, not only were they adjacent to the park, but they had similar resources. You know, they had exposures of petrified wood and the same kind of archaeological resources and those sorts of things. And so it was kind of like, okay, so we should, you know, we should take a look at this changing landscape out here and see how the park should be expanded in light of that. And I mentioned in our last interview that I'd made kind of a point of visiting all of the sections, the square miles that made up Petrified Forest National Park, just to do a kind of a cursory interview of what was out there. And I'd also looked at land outside the park, and one of the ranches, the ranch that had been acquired for the Navajo Nation, I'd actually, mostly in my Eskimo days, but I'd gone out and cowboyed on that land with the rancher. He'd discovered that it was a lot cheaper to get us rangers to come out and help him with his cattle than it would be to hire real cowboys, I guess.
Oh, gee.
So I tell people, you know, I was never that good of a cowboy, but I was never so bad that I had to pay to play cowboy. But I was never so good that I got paid to play cowboy. So that gave me, you know, that gave me some more familiarity with the land out there. And so we'd come up with a general management plan, and in doing that, we'd been working with the state land department, because, like I said, the land outside the park was mostly a checkerboard of state and private land, with not a whole lot of federal land, BLM land, out there. So we'd been working with the state land department. We'd been working with the Trust for Public Lands because they could be a holding organization for lands in the process of being transferred from private ownership into the park, and that sort of thing. And so we'd worked with them. Plus, we'd been working with various researchers, other ranchers, Holbrook Chamber of Commerce, and all that sort of stuff, to develop the general management plan. And then to facilitate the whole thing, because a general management plan is something that only happens about every 10 to 20 years in a park.
Right.
So the people in the park aren't really expert on how to do the whole thing. So there are teams in the Denver Service Center, up in Denver, Colorado, that work with parks to produce general management plans. So we had some folks from Denver, one person in particular, Larry Norris, who was helping to produce the Petrified Forest General Management Plan.
All right.
And it took a while, you know, for him to get a hang of, you know, what we were looking for and the resources resources of the park and that sort of thing as well, and for him to educate us on what we needed to do to make a viable plan. So when the whole thing was done, we had changed superintendents. We'd gone, Ed Gastelum was superintendent earlier, and then Gary Cummins replaced Ed. I don't remember where Ed went, but somewhere in there, Gary Cummins became park superintendent.
How do you spell Gary's last name?
C-U-M-M-I-N-S.
Thank you.
Yeah, he was later deputy superintendent at Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And we, you know, we'd go, since we were looking at practically doubling the size of the park, we were also working with the regional office, and the whole general management plan was kind of, it wasn't the first time I'd worked with the, when we say upper echelons or whatever, of the Park Service, but it was the first time I'd had to work closely with them.
Okay.
I'm sitting at a table with the regional director, and instead of him giving a speech to the employees assembled, he and I are actually discussing points of, you know, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
That sort of thing.
Right.
So it was, you know, it was interesting in terms of being able to plot out the future of Petrified Forest, but it was also interesting just from a procedural standpoint of doing those sorts of things.
Cool.
So we came up with, eventually, as it was finally written up, and it was approved shortly after I left Petrified Forest in 1991. I think we'd issued the draft plan while I was still there, and then the final plan was approved within a year or so after I left Petrified Forest.
Is that still their operational plan today, or have they updated it?
As far as I know, yeah, it's still the general management plan for the park.
Mm.
And they're still working on it. We had identified some park boundaries, expanded park boundaries, and a few, I don't want to say cosmetic, but a few minor changes to some of the visitor facilities that were available in the park. And then the other big thing that we had called for was the establishment of a paleontological research center in the park, somewhat similar to what Dinosaur National Monument had, where they had extensive collections. They had a fossil preparator on staff who could take the fossils encased in rock from the field and gradually chip away the rock and produce the fossil for research. And a museum and laboratories and all that kind of stuff, so that we would have a research staff on board, kind of a skeleton research staff on board that could conduct some baseline research for the park and then also be there to assist outside researchers when they came in. And it was, you know, I thought it was, when I was working on it, I thought it was a good idea, but I didn't see where the funding could come from.
Always the question. Yeah, where is the funding going to come from?
Right, and that was something that actually has proven true. It's the park still doesn't have everything that the general management plan back in 91 or 92 had called for.
Wow.
But at the same time, I think that that they are definitely moving, still continuing to move in that direction.
Okay.
So they went through some rough times in the early 90s, but they have right now they have a really good paleontologist on staff, Bill
cool.
Parker, and he is doing really good work there, and so the research center is kind of growing organically. The general management plan calls for it, and he's kind of growing it incrementally to fill in that structure,
nice.
Getting the research done, working with outside researchers, and proving the worth of the park's paleontological resources. the other thing that we were working on, the park expansion, really hit a roadblock. Right about the time that the Bureau of Land Management and the Arizona State Land Department had pretty much agreed that, yeah, this was a good idea, the park expansion. And so what they would do is they would trade land, which is something that BLM and the state had done numerous times in the past, where they go in and they say, okay, here's a section of state land that BLM would like to have. Here's some land over here that the state would like to have. They appraise the value to make sure that they're both the same real estate value, and then they swap them.
Got it.
And so that way, you know, for example, the BLM can consolidate holdings while the state can acquire land, say, close to Phoenix, that then they can turn around and sell for big bucks or
right,
whatever.
Right.
And so it was a system that worked well. Unfortunately, the Constitution of the state of Arizona says that all state land will be disposed of at auction to the highest bidder.
Ooh.
And for a long time they said, well, we're not disposing of the land, we're just trading it.
Right.
We're not losing land, we're not disposing of land, we're just swapping it around. But there was a court case, and the Arizona Supreme Court said, no, that doesn't cut it. If you want to trade with BLM, BLM has to be the highest bidder at a public auction.
Ooh.
And so that put a big kibosh on one of the key pieces of the expansion plan for Petrified Forest.
Oh, wow.
And they actually, for I don't know how many elections, it was a bunch of elections, they tried to amend the Constitution that would allow the state to swap land of equal value so they could get back to the old land swapping, and it failed every time.
Hmm.
So that wasn't working out very well. Then, oh gosh, what was that congressman's name? He eventually wound up in prison. But anyway. Renzi?
Yeah, Rick Renzi.
Yeah, I think he was the one. Anyway, he actually did introduce legislation, and eventually it was passed to expand the boundaries of Petrified Forest National Park.
Okay.
Out actually even beyond what we had looked at. You know, our boundary was based on resource areas and that kind of stuff. His boundary was more based on existing landowners and ranches and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I wasn't involved in the actual bill, so I don't know what kind of horse trading went on to adjust those boundaries from what we had proposed
mm-hmm.
to what was actually done. But it happened, the boundaries of a Petrified Forest, shortly after I left, within a few years, more than doubled. The park more than doubled in size, in theory, but the bill had no funding for land acquisition. So the park had, the boundaries had expanded tremendously, but within that big expansion, there were a few odd sections of Bureau of Land Management land that instantly transferred over to the National Park Service, and then the rest of it remained state and private land. And
oh, wow. So the state and private land is still state and private land, even though the boundaries of the park... So these are they basically become in-holdings in the park.
Yeah, uh-huh, uh-huh. And it was a real headache for the landowners, from what I understand. This is after I left, of course, so I'm not up on everything. But from what I understand, the landowners, the ranchers, whose land was now within the park, people decided, oh, there must be good stuff there. And so you would have these pot hunters and,
oh, wow.
You know, people coming in after petrified wood, just trashing their ranch land, going after these resources. The Park Service couldn't do anything about it because it wasn't federal land yet.
Right.
And so these ranchers were kind of left holding the bag. And I've looked, you know, I haven't followed it closely, but I think a lot of that new addition
Yeah, this is always, it always comes down to the matter of funding. You have good ideas. Well, we'll do a research center. Oh, we're gonna expand the park, but we have no money to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Or the money gets taken off to a different project altogether.
Right, right.
Reallocated.
And sometimes, you know, you can get charitable contributions or whatever.
Right.
But you just don't know. So that was the general management plan, and like I said, you know, the park did get expanded, and is I think I'd be safe to say most of it now is federal land.
Nice.
And the research center maybe isn't what we'd envisioned, isn't the size that we'd envisioned at first, but it's gradually coming around as well, mostly from the hard work that's going on there in the park today.
Yeah. Do you, I'm just going to flash forward to today, do you try to stay in touch with what's going on out there?
No, not really.
Okay.
A little bit, but not a whole lot.
Okay. All right. So did your acting position ever get filled before you left?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did. Eventually they did bring in a new chief ranger, and excuse me, his name was Kerry Eisensee, and it's let's see, he
how do you spell that?
Eisensee.
Thank you.
And he came in in the summer of 1989, and so I could get back to the resource management type stuff that I had been doing before. Of course, it was a lot of just kind of trying to pick up the pieces where I'd left off. But,
you know, Carl, I've got a question just thinking about institutional memory. You mentioned that when Chris left, he had it all kind of in his head. When Kerry showed up, Eisensee, I'm assuming that you were there, and you know, it would have been easier for him to come into that job because he had someone who knew what was involved, who the players were, what the issues were, what the budgets were, and could just hand that stuff all over to him.
Yeah, and I was just right downstairs if he had any questions.
Which is handy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was, you know, and you know, he was bringing in his own experience.
Okay.
From wherever, I think he came from St. Croix.
Oh, wow.
In Wisconsin, in Minnesota, I think it is.
So, big change for him.
Yeah, big change, and so he took over, and I got back to kind of doing my resource management stuff, which was essentially, you know, continuing very much the same kind of work I'd been doing before that we talked about in the last session, Nothing, as I think about it, nothing really pops out from that time period. I know that period of time from when he came on board in 89 to when I left in 91, I know I was getting more involved in pest management and in managing rights of way and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, it was those same kinds of jobs, but it was kind of I really was not enjoying working for Kerry once he got settled in.
Okay.
So I started looking around for other possibilities, and you know, just a lot of frustrations. And I know that let's just say I wasn't alone in my frustration. I think my going away party when I transferred up to Grand Canyon was actually a consolidated one for about six people.
Oh wow. Well, this is interesting. And oftentimes, people in the service, if they've messed up, they get bumped up, or they get another job someplace else, and they take those difficulties with them to someplace else. And at least when they leave, the people that are still remaining in the shattered mess heave a big sigh of relief. But then the individual shows up someplace else to start, you know, making a mess at a new place.
Yeah, and it was one of those where it was funny because I was part of the, what do I say, the selection process for the new chief ranger. You know, we had the superintendent had gone through the applications that had been referred to the park, and decided, you know, which ones he thought were ones, you know, that which applicants were ones that he wanted to pursue. And then he had me and the two district rangers go through those applications, and then the four of us, me, the district rangers, and the superintendent, did some telephone interviews and then made a selection. And so it's not to say that, you know, we were completely unawares. We thought he looked like the best candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
Turns out that at least from my standpoint, turns out that this isn't that great.
Mm.
And it was a lot of I don't know what to say, but I didn't get along with him.
Uh-huh. And it's interesting. It makes me think that when a new superintendent arrives at a park, they might do what they can to bring in people that they've worked with in the past, because that might be better than working with the people that are there. And not being a superintendent, not having that ability to say, well, you know, this isn't working out, so I'm going to get rid of him and bring in somebody else. You're then left with the only option, which is to leave and go someplace else.
Yeah, and it was, you know, we did change superintendents. It was Ed Gastelum had been superintendent. And then during that time, Gary Cummins came on board. And
Gary get along with Kerry?
Well, while I was there, they were just real chummy.
Okay.
And apparently later on, Gary did become disillusioned.
Okay.
But that was part of the frustration, was having this much trouble, and he just wasn't seeing it, wasn't sympathetic to it.
Okay.
And so I had started looking around. The other thing, it wasn't just that I didn't get along with the chief ranger, but it was also a case of I had so many different job responsibilities, and in the resource management arena, and while I'd gotten training in a lot of them, and I was kind of keeping my head above water once I wasn't chief ranger anymore, kind of keeping my head above water, I was also feeling, I don't know, maybe the best word to say is insecure. It's kind of like, okay, well, this is working okay for us, but how should it really work? And I was thinking, you know, maybe if I got into a bigger park and worked in a larger resource management division, I could learn more about how all these different pieces can fit together.
Okay.
And some of the other resources that are out there that might be able to help me to accomplish that. And so I was, you know, scanning the vacancy announcements and all that sort of thing. And
what was Lori doing?
Lori was she was in interpretation, and she was the district interpreter for the north end of the park. So she was bringing on different seasonals, and you know running that operation.
Okay.
And then she was also managing the park museum collection. And I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but the Park Service was finally instituting a computerized collections management system. And Petrified Forest was one of the testing grounds for it. Because they wanted a park. It was easy for them to come up with parks with big historical collections or archaeological collections or whatever, but they wanted a park that had geology and paleontology as part of the mix, and Petrified Forest was that park.
Right. And you did mention this last time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, when I first came to Petrified Forest, our museum collection was just some cabinets in a workroom that we used for, you know, answering information requests, and we had a work table in there that we used for drafting, and it was also kind of a break room, and not exactly the real what do I want to say, climate controlled and all that kind of stuff that you use for collections today.
Right. How was?
So,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, and so one of the things that that she had to do was kind of up our game a little bit with regard to collections.
Cool.
And she, the collections had grown, and she kind of took over that room and then piled up the cabinets in such a way as they kind of made a wall around the opening sides all faced in, just blank sheets on the outside, and then put a gate with a lock on it. So that it was hard to get in there, although that didn't stop one of our researchers from climbing up on top of the cabinets and shimmying across between the top of the cabinet and the bottom of the ceiling so you could get into them. But anyway.
Wow. Was that for theft or just because they needed to get in the building there?
He just wanted to check something, and she wasn't around to let him in. And
okay.
Just climbed over the storage case.
Good to know that there's a way to do that. We need to take care of that.
I don't think that would work so well anymore.
How was Lori dealing with the boredom of the interpretive job?
She was a manager, so she wasn't during the summertime not stuck out, just working the desk all the time.
Okay,
but it was telling and. You know, she was, there were a lot of, you know, she was feeling various frustrations working with some of the more intransigent researchers who really didn't want to do all the paperwork that they had to do and work things. And eventually she actually got offered the... number two position with the Petrified Forest Museum Association. She was got offered a job as assistant manager, and so she resigned from the Park Service and took that.
Wow.
And that would have been in 1990. It was kind of like, no, I'm not getting anywhere here, and in her current position, it was just getting too frustrating, and so she went to work for the Cooperating Association. And did quite well.
I would think that would again with a couple that is trying to figure out dual careers, it can be problematic if if one individual says, well, the only way to advance my career is to leave this park and go to another park, but the other partner is, you know, well anchored in a good job.
Yeah. And it was, you know, that was the, what do I want to say? That was where we wound up at that point. But by the time, she had, by the time she decided to move, I was already getting pretty fed up as well. And so, you know, I think the writing was on the wall that we weren't going to be a Petrified Forest a whole lot longer.
Okay, but if she took over the association job, how was that going to work out if you headed off to a different park?
Well, it was kind of to jump ahead in the story, just a little bit. In April of 1991, we moved to Grand Canyon. So in a 3-week period, I transferred, she quit, we moved, and we had our first child.
Okay.
So it was kind of a case of, okay, these big changes were looming.
Got it.
And they all kind of came together all at once.
Okay. All right. That often happens again with couples that you know, things change with children, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she had, she'd been looking at, it wasn't the reason for the move, but she, especially once we got to Grand Canyon, she was thinking that, no, you know, now what I need is a job where I can go to work during the day and then come home and turn it off at night.
Yeah.
And so I was looking more at admin type jobs. So, and that's eventually what she wound up doing at Grand Canyon.
Okay. Let's go back to Petrified Forest for a minute. Did the park at Petrified have a aircraft management plan at that time?
No.
Okay.
I guess every now and then a scenic tour might fly over the park. Our big problem was we were out in the middle of nowhere. Middle of ranch land, the empty Navajo Nation off to the north of us, and surrounded by ranches and all that kind of stuff. So our big aircraft management plan was actually B-52s and B-1 bombers.
Okay.
That were using landscape features and facilities in the park as targets.
Ooh.
On training runs.
Okay.
And so they never dropped anything on us, but
they would come in low.
They would be
targeting
very, very low.
Wow.
And I was out hiking in the Painted Desert one day, and this B-52 came by, and I waved to the guy, and he was low enough that he could see me waving because he waggled his wings.
Aww.
as he flew by. And we'd be working in the Rainbow Forest Museum at the south end of the park, and all of a sudden there'd be this tremendous boom coming through from them practicing dive bombing the museum.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of stuff. So that was when Ed Gastelum was superintendent. He actually went all the way up. I think it was the assistant secretary, but it might have been the secretary of the Air Force, to get him to quit doing that. And eventually they did reroute their training courses so they weren't over the park anymore.
Great.
And it was kind of amusing because I remember at his going away party, when he transferred out, right in the middle of the party, a B-52 came over. Just, I mean, you couldn't have reached up and touched it, but for a while there, it seemed like you could have. Came right over, right in the middle of his going away party. It was kind of like, Okay, that was on purpose.
How did they
How did they
know?
know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well, they
yeah.
did. You know, it's interesting because we don't think about natural quiet as a resource to be protected in national parks. And
Right.
it's
And at
only.
that time, it really wasn't. It was something, when I got to Grand Canyon, that was an issue that we were dealing with up there.
Yeah.
But at Petrified Forest, it wasn't.
I mean, it wasn't an issue identified, I suppose, for the management plan yet, but it was definitely something that needed to be considered. And clearly, you were having troubles there with the military.
Yeah, and I'm not, what do I want to say? Off the top of my head, aside from the military overflights, I don't remember anything else
Okay.
that was an issue.
Okay.
So that wasn't an issue that we had to deal with. And we didn't have, thinking about Grand Canyon and some of the issues that I wound up being at least somewhat involved with up there, kind of amusing. But most of the time there was no surface water in the park, so that wasn't an issue. Although at one time, for who knows what reason, two big cases of water safety in the national parks brochures were delivered to the park. And it's kind of like, what
Really?
are we going to do with these? People, we hadn't had a problem with people on the sewage lagoons, and that would be the only place. But we put them out on the de information desk
Oh my
at the
gosh.
visitor centers, and within a few days they were all gone.
I
People
just
picked them up anyway.
shipped them up to Lake Powell National Recreation Area to the north, and they could use them much
Yeah,
better.
that's right. That's right.
Oh my gosh.
So,
Huh. That's amazing. Must have gotten more. Well, maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series because it sounds like you're just about ready to go to Grand Canyon.
right. Yep. I had been applying around,
Okay.
and anymore these days, I don't remember what other positions, parks, or whatever I applied to, but
Okay.
my goal was to get into a park with a larger resource management program so I could learn more about resource management.
Was
And
Grand Canyon hiring it? I mean, were they doing an active search at the time?
eventually they were, and that's where I don't remember it wasn't like a slam dunk. Like when I moved to Grand Canyon in interpretation in '83, I was a known quantity.
Okay.
I'd worked there just a couple years before. Some of the hierarchy was still the same. Like Jack O'Brien was still there and that kind of stuff. So my name shows up on the register, and it's kind of, oh, look, here's Carl. Yeah, we'd like to have Carl back again. And so that one, when I put in for that job, I had an inside track, I guess you could say, and that sort of thing. When the Petrified, or when I was trying to leave Petrified and go to Grand Canyon in resource management, that wasn't the case. It was more a case of, okay, here's a resource management job. I know Grand Canyon, so I'll put in for that. And we can talk about more about that job, when we talk about it. But it wasn't a custom fit or anything like that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, some in these oral histories, I'm learning oftentimes an individual from a park will go to another park, track an individual down, observe them, talk with them just out of the blue. Hi, I'm just curious. Tell me about this, tell me about that. But they're actually scouting that individual out for that position. And then we'll say, okay, well, we'd like you to come, and a bunch of people are going to apply, and you're going to apply too, but we're looking to give you the job. It's kind of an inside network, if you will.
It doesn't sound
like you had that going at.
For the interim job in '83, that was kind of the deal. Mm. I knew when the job was in the pipeline. I knew that they were they weren't writing the job for me, but they were thinking about me, and that sort of thing. Whereas when I went in '91 for the resource management job, that wasn't the case.
Right.
People knew me, but it wasn't a job that, oh yeah, this would be a great one for Carl.
Got it. Well, Crumbo was working in there, and you had worked with him. I mean, you'd known him on the river, so mm-hmm. so you had some name recognition in the resource management office, I would think.
Yeah, that's true. And Crumbo and also this is what happens when you get old.
Johnny Ray, I'm thinking, might have been there.
Johnny Ray was there, although I didn't know him at the time.
Okay, all right.
Jen Balsam.
Okay.
The person I was trying to pick up. And how I could forget her name, but anyway,
do it
one.
Yeah.
Jen Balsam was probably the one who knew me best.
And she was working in archaeology, and you had archaeology going at Petrified,
I hadn't really worked with Jan because most of my dealings for archaeology had been through Trinkle Jones at the Western Archaeological Center.
Ah, okay.
And Jan and Trinkle were good friends.
Got it.
But I didn't have nearly as much of the hands-on archaeology stuff. Except for the reburial,
okay.
as I did with like the paleontology and that sort of thing.
Okay, I wonder, because Jan certainly would have heard about that reburial, I bet, and so maybe there was a connection there. Anyway, you weren't.
Could be. The reburial was kind of amusing. Karen Bergeron was at Grand Canyon when I was there in interpretation. And then she went on to become superintendent of Homolivi State Park outside of Winslow.
Oh.
And I ran into Karen a number of times over the years, but I told her the story, and she goes, well, that's interesting, because they'd had a reburial at Homolivi, and the procedure was very different. And I don't remember exactly what they did at Homolivi. But we decided that, you know, at that time, NAGPRA, the whole consultation thing was just first getting off the ground, and it was what we decided, which may or may not be true, but what we'd kind of figured out was that the tribes were in their own process of figuring out. Okay, these federal agencies are calling us for these different issues. How are we going to handle them?
Right.
And so they were in a learning curve as well.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you spell Karen's last name?
It's B-E-R, and I think G-G. E-R-E-N.
Okay. Better than I could have done. Good.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a double G, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, she was the at Grand Canyon. I know that she was in charge of the museum collection. I don't know, and at that time, the museum collection was part of the interpretation division. But I don't know if she had any field responsibilities as well, or if that was her whole job.
So did she go from Grand Canyon's museum collection to being Super Homali?
I think so.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. Okay. Anything else? Last chance, last look back at Petrified Forest before we head to Grand Canyon.
Yeah, let me scan through this here real quick. Oh yeah. I had to free up people to go fight the fires in Yellowstone when I was acting.
Oh. And you would just basically cut back on your staffing levels for, say, Department of Interpretation, just those people that had red cards to fight fires would just take off? Right. How would that work?
Yeah, and we didn't actually have that many red-carded people at Petrified Forest.
Okay.
But yeah, it was just basically a case of, okay, where can we trim back? And I think we only sent a couple of people.
Was that a directive coming to all service units from regions saying,
yeah,
you've got extra personnel, send them to Yellowstone?
Yeah, it was a case of they just basically said we need to put together more fire crews. It's long enough ago now, I don't remember just how it came through. This was I think the incident command system that they use today was just first starting up about that time.
Right.
And so I just don't remember the procedural stuff.
And were they like driving away with your brand new fire truck, or were they just individuals going up there?
We only sent people on that one.
Okay.
We didn't have any wildland equipment.
So right, you got nothing to burn.
Yeah, we did have a couple of little grass and brush fires that we responded to.
Okay.
At Petrified Forest, but we would always respond with we had basically a medium-sized structural fire truck.
Okay.
At each end of the park, and so that's what we would send. And so if the fire was very far off the road, there was nothing we could do about it. But
right.
All of our fires were right next to the road, so it worked out.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Easy to get to with a hose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Did you end up going to Yellowstone? I mean, you had fire skill.
No, they had talked about me going because I did have a red card, but it was kind of like no, I can't. You know, I was in a position where no, there's nobody that could backfill.
Okay.
So I didn't go.
Okay.
I did wind up, we had one of our people that was actually up there for quite a while, and what do we want to say? They basically decided to allow themselves a little R&R visit home rather than coming directly back to the park, and so they were technically AWOL.
Ooh.
On the way back, and it was kind of like, okay, disciplinary action was mandatory, but it was also their transgression was also perfectly understandable.
Right.
And so kind of a case of, okay, how are we going to handle this? As I remember, the disciplinary action was pretty minimal. You're going to get a day without pay or something like that. But.
Yeah, but it goes on their record, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Well, with that, how about we wrap up part 10? What are you thinking?
Yeah, that sounds good. And then we can we can pick up with the last, whatever, 12 years of my career up at Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Whatever it was. No, it was more than that. 22 years.
I was thinking, I was like, wait a minute, that's working out the math.
That doesn't sound right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that'll take a little while, so that's good. This will then conclude part 10, oral history interview with Carl Bowman. Today is Monday, November 30th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Carl, thank you so very much.
Yep, my pleasure, Tom.